welcome to Movies, Films, and Flicks. I am Mark Hoffmeyer, and joining me is a man who, after watching the latest trailer for the newest Tremors film, took 2 tablespoons of cement, swallowed them, and now he thinks he's a hardened man.
I gotta harden up. I feel like Vin Diesel about to fight a tremor.
I mean, like, so you have you have cement inside you right now. How's it feel?
Like I could out-grapple a graboid.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Like, so, like, you do the old wrestling thing, like, you know, when you walk with, like, your hands out in the air and you have your palms open, ready to, like, grab the other guy's palms, and then you, like, twist them down. You know what I'm talking about? Like, you're kind of, feeling them out.
Like for the sumo wrestler against Van Damme in Bloodsport.
Yeah, you're right.
He snaps, and then he pulls him in for the bear hug. I will bear hug a graboid. And you've seen the way I eat when I go away out of town for a weekend. I gain 15 pounds in 2 days. I think that if you gave me a week to fatten up, I will be in a graboid's weight class.
I think you would let the graboid eat you so you could eat it from, like, the belly out.
So I could pull a Kevin Costner Mariner Sea Beast kill. That sea – he killed that thing so easily. I want to know what caliber his harpoon gun was, because it didn't just shoot a harpoon in the side of the animal. It, like, exploded like it had a detonation.
Yeah, and there's nothing – there's no – I've watched that clip hundreds of times. There's no missiles in there. There's no, like, electricity. So it just kind of – if he shot that thing in real life, it just would have gone – in the
he monster. He had a chewed up bubblegum sized bit of C4 attached to that. And Mark, by the way, I think we mentioned it. Mark wrote he wrote a thesis. He wrote like 700 or 800 words. And he has like original illustrations, not harvested from the internet, depicting this whole scenario. But like that thing legit explodes out of both sides.
Yeah, and I don't get it. That movie. And you know what the whole thing is? Those women are fishing, and they're just being proactive. They're like, "Hey, we're gonna catch fish." He takes his fishing poles and he throws them off the boat, and then he turns on his trolling motor, but he doesn't unleash his cable. He just takes a cheeky rope and gets dragged by it, gets eaten by the monster, the boat floats away, the monster sinks, he gets out, he leaves his gun, he catches the boat, turns the boat around, dives down, cuts off slabs of meat, swims back up, then he has to start a fire, he has massive things of meat. This is a long process.
Wait, let's just say that, because when we saw him at the floating stronghold, he swam pretty fast.
Oh, yeah.
And let's just say that the thing sinks slowly. But it's still a lot of time, right? And the other thing is that if he swims down 200 feet quickly, he's going to get the bends.
Yep. I mean, I actually broke down all the speed that he goes, the speed that the creature goes, the speed that it sinks, how fast the boat is going. I broke down every facet of this stupid scene.
I mean, when you get a whale that is ascending or descending in the water, the whale's body is a lot bigger. It has more resilience to the pressure of the water. Right. It's not immune to it though, right? But so if you have a human body though, it's not like they're just adapted to be at any pressure. Deep sea fish can't just rise quickly. It needs to be gradual and they have limits. You can't just move a deep sea fish up 200 feet and have it be fine.
Costner ain't got no limits.
Apparently not. He's like one of the later Fast and Furious sequels in terms of handling water pressure, you know, where now they're all Marvel superheroes.
Yeah. They're like a combination of Snake Plissken from Escape from L.A., Kevin Costner from Waterworld, and Stallone from and Cliffhanger. Because Stallone in that film takes Leon and presses him up in the air and spikes him through a massive, I don't know, whatever hangs from a cliff, a cave.
That's impressive.
I mean, who wins? Cliffhanger, Mariner, Snake Plissken.
I mean, come on, man. If people have heard our pod from day one, they know we got to go with Kurt Russell.
I asked that question. I went, that's stupid. Snake Plissken wins.
I mean, if you take out Snake Plissken, it's like that. It's a little tougher.
I mean, they cut out a scene in the Cliffhanger trailer. So I just wrote a post about The Rock jumping from the skyscraper. Of course, he's going to die, but I went from an angle of like who else has done this. And if you look at the skyscraper poster with The Rock jumping, you'll see that's just a very far distance. But I saw a trailer for Cliffhanger where he jumps total, perfectly horizontal. He jumps like 40 feet just across.
It's too much.
And it never made the movie. And some guy was – no, but in a Cliffhanger.
Oh, in Cliffhanger.
He does a 40-foot totally horizontal jump.
So he did a McConaughey lead.
Yeah, and it's never been in – it wasn't in the movie. So I was like, guys, it doesn't count. Because a lot of people were bringing up various. I was like, humans only with no special powers, and people are like, The Matrix. I'm like, no.
Right. Yeah. He jumped like a quarter mile in The Matrix. It's like, yeah, in a computer simulation. Yeah.
Wanted. No. Like John Carter. Uh-uh. You know,
I mean,
Fly Green
Tomato. When I was Super Mario, I jumped and headbutted a ceiling block of metal so hard that a flower came out of it. I'm not going to try that in real life. Yeah, I will die. Right.
I will die. Someone did say Mario. But these are non-propelled humans jumping, and The Rock broke every record known to man.
They're like Sonic the Hedgehog with a rolling start.
Yeah.
Hulk.
Oh, yeah.
Hulk jumps miles at a time.
But Mark Ruffalo tries it. He's not clearing much ground.
He with a standstill, he's clearing like 4 feet.
He's rolling an ankle. All right, so before we get into our listener questions, if you were fighting a tremor, would you fireman carry it? Or would you try to put it in a head and arm? Because that'd be pretty easy, because it's just a big head.
Grappling would be tough. I just know that I'd have to start the same way that I'd start if someone dipped an axe into a fish. And I just have to get a running start drop kick on him.
Yeah. Oh, kick it right in the side?
Yeah. Like, I mean, you know, just see what happens. That will also be me testing the water.
Yeah.
You know, see what I can get with it. But I mean, I kind of like the idea of it eating me. But do you think that the proportionality of me to a graboid is similar to Kevin Costner to the Sea Beast?
No, I think you'd be dead.
Because it would chew me. It would have to snap me somewhere.
You can't like dive right. Like remember in Land of the Lost, Will Ferrell dives into the T-Rex's mouth, then comes out its butt. Like you couldn't do that with a tremor.
You know what would happen? It would snap off my legs. I'd still defeat it by ripping out from the inside. Then I get two prosthetic legs. And then I jump 60 feet from a crane like The Rock.
Oh, there it is. Tremors 5.
That's how The Rock's character in Skyscraper ended up with the prosthetic leg.
A tremor bit it off?
Tremor, because he killed a tremor single-handedly. That's why.
I like it. That's his backstory. I don't need to see the movie now.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of want to see the prequel now, though, because I want to see him fight Tremor.
That sounds more exciting than Die Hard with The Rock.
See, like Lou Cobbs from Fast and Furious, he would just punch it once and it would explode because he's superhuman. But this is like a schlub who happens to be an amateur bodybuilder in his spare time, but a schlub nonetheless. So I pay to watch that fight.
I came up with a funny title for because he has Rampage, San Andreas, Skyscraper, all these movies about natural disasters. I want to see a movie called The Day After Dwayne Johnson.
Like Dwayne, it's the next day after a Fast and Furious movie. You just see the city.
Oh, no. Like, let's say, like, somehow he's out of commission. And then the world just goes terrible because there's no one there to fist fight tsunamis.
Someone's got to fist fight. And it's not Owen Wilson. He's just going to run from them.
Whoa. No, wait. He said, wow. That's what Owen Wilson does. Wow. And Keanu Reeves goes, whoa. And Jim Varney goes, Ernest goes, you know what I mean, Vern?
And then he gets no response. I miss Jim Varney.
You know, all right, guys, we're going to get into this topic. It's a great topic. We've actually been really excited, but I got to tell you a story about Ernest. And so he started off in commercials, and Ernest was like a huge brand back in the day. Just millions of people saw commercials with Ernest. One Christmas, there was an ad where Ernest was trying to go into Vern's Christmas party, and Vern just straight up was like, no, and shut the door in his face, so Ernest had to spend Christmas alone. People were so mad about this ad, they had to go back and film a 15-second ad for New Year's, where Vern opens up the door and Ernest goes, hey, Happy New Year, Vern, and smashes him with a pie to like get his revenge. And that's not even Ernest. Ernest wouldn't do that. But people were so enraged at Vern that they had to film Ernest getting back at Vern because thousands of people were sending letters.
And then in all the movies where he mentions Vern, they could never show Vern's face again because they know people would go into blood rages.
28 days later, zombies just attacking Vern.
Okay. Well, I think we have pretty sure we got some listener questions today.
Yeah, and all these listener questions, they tie to something, right?
Well, all of our listener questions are specifically about today's movie that we're discussing.
And we've been talking about this film 4 or 5 years ago. I was in a Costco parking lot, and you and I were talking about whether a director's cut would be better or worse for the film we're talking about, Event Horizon. And we were like, man, we have great conversations. And now it's come full circle where we're podcasting about it on our 118th episode.
As it turns out, at the end of the episode, our very last listener question is specifically about that.
Nice. I mean, I remember I was just sitting. I wasn't even going inside Costco. We were just sitting in the car. I was like talking to you about it.
Dude, ever since I saw this, well, I shouldn't say ever since. Ever since DVDs were out, existed, and I saw it again, I feel like that's the thing that every movie lover who sees this movie says. They're like, man, I wonder what the extended cut, or I wonder what the unrated cut, or I wonder what the director's cut, just insert special cut here. I wonder what that would be like. And everyone is specifically thinking about like those horrible visions of hell. Not that there aren't other cool things that there could be, right? But yeah, so all the questions are about Event Horizon today. We even have some comments about it too that we'll share. But first one, all these, by the way, came from Twitter. The first one comes from Scarescapes. That's at D Carner with a K on Twitter. And Scarescapes asks, what could be creepier than a ship that opens a portal to hell?
As a joke, I just kind of thought a clown car that opens to a portal to hell.
Well, clowns are pretty So did the clowns come out all with like a visage of like hell?
No, you're stuck in it with them.
So wait, not only am I in hell, but I'm in a crowded car where I can barely move, and it's filled with scared clowns that are panicking?
Yep.
That does actually sound like even more uncomfortable than simply being in hell.
And you can't really move because you're locked in. So you're just...
Oh, dude, so if you see something coming, if the it that follows was coming towards you, you're just stuck, like, against the rear passenger window, like, yeah, with your cheek pressed against it, looking at the it that follows that's coming towards you in hell.
And all these clowns are crying and ripping out their eyes and just having a blood orgy in the car. And you're just sitting there, squish. You can't move. You can't move. You have a hand stuck, you know, like someone's rubbing the back of your head. Like, it's just like a clown car to hell.
I was kind of wondering, though. So when they say what could be creepier than this, and having seen the movie and the things that the movie does, and it is haunting you about like people who died and someone is haunted by their very sick child. I can't like. Creepy kids in horror movies is one thing. Ghost kids is one thing. If it is your kid that is literally haunting you over your guilt in a hell ship, like that, it's really hard to beat that. So I just had to go with generic answers, like honestly, evil baby movies.
Or what about a evil boat that's surrounded by
like ghost ship?
That's yeah, like ghost ship.
Surrounded by zombie sharks?
Yeah, surrounded by zombie sharks. But see, the thing is, you could jump out of the boat, but what's in the water? Like, you're in the middle of the ocean, you're dead anyway.
Maybe the boat's nice. Is there an orchestra?
It's like The Shining, but a boat.
Oh, okay, that's not cool then.
Right? So you're on this boat, and you're like, I could jump in the water, but I'm in the middle of the Pacific, it's stormy out, and you're going to probably drown.
That's not pleasant.
So, I mean, it's the thing is, though, you have an out. In space, you don't have an out because you're stuck, right? So what would be worse, to be stuck and know you can't leave, or to know you have an option, but that option's equally as terrifying?
I don't know. I'm tempted. You know, I think the Event Horizon really nailed it. I want to just go with being on the Event Horizon is worse.
All right.
I feel like when you give me a choice, you give me a chance to step up and be brave. And I feel like the people on the Event Horizon didn't have that choice.
Oh yeah. They were, I mean, they did the best they could. So are we
saying, like, even if you give someone insurmountable odds, if you give them options, they can do something that can, from which they can draw inspiration. Everything felt hopeless in this movie.
Yeah, you're right.
To me.
So we got Event Horizon, clown car, Shining boat. So
I do have one thing. It's not a scenario where you're in a vessel, though. And that was just, this movie reminds me a lot of components of Hellraiser. And then Hellraiser 1 and 2. In the first one, it's Frank. And in the second movie, it's Julia, the woman who was helping Frank in the first movie. When they get their victims to come back from hell, and they are these skinless, weakened ghouls, they get you by, like, jamming their hand in the back of your neck and then kind of like sucking out all of your essence and fluids while you're alive to reconstitute their bodies. And that strikes me as the most horrible, creepy thing It's just that it's that will only last 2 minutes of your life. Okay. Whereas the clown car, the ghost ship, the event horizon, those are voyages that you are stuck on. You don't get an easy out after two horribly painful minutes.
I think the creepiest world for me is knowing that stupid troll from Ernest Scared Stupid's hunting me down in a dark school, right?
And all your Miak is at home.
Yeah, all my Miak's at home. It's a dark, locked school, and I have that troll chasing me around, using different voices. I mean, I just got goosebumps.
That troll was strong. I mean, he was tough. Like, you can't box him. You can't Krav Maga him.
I literally just got goosebumps talking about that.
If you break his nose, he has a whole nother nose.
I mean, it's a huge nose.
It's like a twin nose.
And there's a lot of snot. So, you know, when people put Vaseline on your face when you're boxing, like, he has snot on his face.
If you punch him and break his nose and you split open your knuckle and you get snot on it, you'll get an infection and die.
Yes. Ernest hit him with a truck and he wasn't bothered by it.
Didn't he like lift the truck off of him?
He pulled the truck. Oh, he just got run over. Then he pulled the truck.
Oh. that was a tough troll. All right. That troll was like Vin Diesel in Fast and the Furious 26 tough. He was like the last witch hunter tough where he can never die.
The hair in the back of my neck is standing up right now.
Because I mentioned Vin Diesel?
Well, no.
Vin Diesel like is that troll.
He's basically Superman in Fast and Furious 26.
It's so ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, I love these movies and all, but all right. Next, our second question comes from the Fear Merchant, also on Twitter. Fear Merchant asks, this is kind of a twin question. How do you rate Sam Neill's dad bod? And how do you rate Lawrence Fishburne before he became Lawrence Fried Fishburne?
First and foremost, Sam Neill was 50 years old when he made this movie. He owns a winery, and whenever he went out with the cast and crew, he and his wife were always the last people to shut it down. I heard this all from the commentary. So if I'm 50 years old, I own a winery, and I close bars down, I would be happy to look like Sam Neill at 50 years old.
So this kind of shocked me. I don't think Sam Neill has a dad bod. And
no.
And you can tell, by the way, that he is sucking in a little bit, but he's not. There's not a lot for him to suck in. Like you see him from behind. You can't suck in sideways. Like, yeah. You see how narrow his waist gets. I mean, he's just sucking it in, I think, because he had. I mean, he also shaved his whole chest, like Charlie Sheen did in The Arrival. So clearly he was proud of the shape he was in at his age. But I mean, I don't call that a dad bod.
That dude's 50. That's not dad bod. That's like. That's good. Like, if I look
that's
like
a dad
that when
bod.
50,
if you're 20, if you're 26, that's a dad bod.
Yeah. If I look like that when I'm 50, I am very happy.
And then the Lawrence Fried Fishburne, I feel a little badly here. I mean, yeah, Lawrence.
Well, it's harsh. It's harsh.
And I've heard this term, the Lawrence Fried Fishburne, before. He did get puffy at some point.
He's looking good now, though. He's looking good now.
Yeah, like he's on that show Blackish.
Yeah, he looks great.
And he's a lot thinner there than he was, or not thinner overall, but like his face is less puffy than it was even in the third Matrix movie, I think.
There's no like news, but maybe he went through something and then he conquered it. Now he's looking better.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, stress. Oh, boy, when I think of just 2 years ago. Oh.
I mean,
stress can do a lot. But yeah,
remember on Predators? Like, he was not looking good on that. I remember he was living on that. He was living on the island by himself. And I was like, what? Like,
that I don't know where he found that Shoney's buffet to get that body on that island.
And I'm normally super nice about movies. I never really insult characters. Like, we joke around about Vin Diesel in Fast and Furious 26. But, like, I'd never, like, mess around with weight or anything. But I did see that movie, and I was like, how? And so, I mean, that was it. But he's looking great now, man. I'm proud of him. You know what? His diet.
The other thing, so Sam Neill, I don't really think it was a dad bod, to be fair. And like you said, he was 50. And I mean, this is several years after Jurassic Park. No one was calling him young in Jurassic Park. And then for Lawrence Fishburne, wasn't he like 30?
Yeah. So, I mean, he's probably, you know, he's up in his 50s now.
I mean, but he was young. I mean, that's hell. No matter how you look at a certain age, if you go back 10 years, you're probably a thinner version of yourself. You know, I think that they're doing okay. I think they are fine. And yes, you know, some weight was clearly gained. And we can, if we want to pick on Sam Neill, we can just think of him in The Vow, where he's the evilest father ever.
Sam Neill?
Wasn't that The Vow?
Was that the Rachel McAdams one with Channing Tatum?
Yeah. Yeah.
I was convinced that was a Nicholas Sparks movie for a long time, but it's not.
I thought it was too. Those parents, I thought that's where you got it for me.
Those parents were terrible. What a bunch of jerks.
Well, those are opening listening questions. We're going to have more at the end of the pod, but we want to leave some room so that we can discuss the movie.
And boy, are we going to discuss this movie. I got to tell you, John. So we decided to do this, and I'm like, I want to do this right, because there's a lot of questions about Event Horizon. It's a bona fide cult classic. It's 20 years old. It's a movie that I want to know a lot about. So I found the Blu-ray, like on last week's podcast we were talking about. I've listened to the commentary twice, watched the movie twice, listened to the behind-the-scenes footage with the commentary. I'm glad we had, like, weeks to prepare for this. I read as many articles as I could. I feel like Event Horizon, much like the ship became the people, like, this movie is, like, part of me, which is kind of weird. It's not a good thing to be putting in your brain. I've noticed a lot more with it, so it's kind of weird to be getting it all out now. Like, I'm going to be going through withdrawals. I'm going to be going through Event Horizon withdrawals after this podcast. Yeah.
And like when we did Bram Stoker pod a couple weeks ago, like I had seen it numerous times, but not for like 15 plus years. So I was revisiting it a couple times in the week before. This is actually a movie that I've seen at least once every single year since it came out. This is like when people say, oh, I've seen it like 20 times. No, I've actually sat down and watched this from start to finish at least 20 times, having nothing to do with this podcast. Which is kind of interesting. This is one of those movies that whenever it's on, I will go find it and start it from the beginning, or even go grab my DVD or something at the time and just start it from the beginning. Like, I always really loved this movie. My cousin also was really into this movie the whole time. So yeah, this is kind of a long time coming for a lot of reasons.
And so inadvertently, I think what this film does. So Paul W.S. Anderson directed Mortal Kombat. People asked him to do X-Men. They asked him to do Alien 4. He turned those down because he wanted to do this movie. Basically, he wanted to do a ghost story on a ship, because there's no way out. You can't just go to like the grocery store. But what I think this movie does really well is these aren't dumb people being put in like a dumb situation. It's smart people who are just put in a horrible situation because they're doing their job. So it's not like... It's not like they're like, oh, hey, let's walk around this corridor. Let's not like when they know that it's too late, it's too late. So I think this is kind of good. Like, I like the idea of this crew who it's not their fault. They got brought to do their mission. They got pulled out of their break. They didn't want to do this. And when they learn it's too late, it's too late. And there's something refreshing about that.
It's very alien, except like even an academic step up from working class.
Yeah. And it's I don't know. I just like that idea. Like, you know, you see some of these movies like Alien Covenant, or like other movies where people are like, oh, hey, there's a planet. Let's go inhabit it. And you're like, no, don't go to this planet you haven't charted. Go to the planet that you have charted. Like, these people are doing their job, and everything that drives them to what, you know, the end, it's not really their fault. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And you know, I'm going to mention Alien a few times. If someone isn't so familiar with Alien and or this movie, don't think that I'm saying that this movie is copying it. I don't think that. I think it's just an influence is present. But like in Alien, much like this movie, our crew did not actually know what they were doing in the first place. It's not just that they didn't know what they were encountering. It's that they didn't even understand what their mission was until they were already there. It was kind of the same thing in both of these, where then it gets revealed, the curtain is drawn on what's really going on. Cause our crew didn't know in the Event Horizon, or in the Lewis and Clark, their ship, they did not know the purpose of their mission until they already were in hypersleep for 2 months, and then got within a week of their target.
Yeah. And basically, like Lawrence Fishburne says, someone drops the ball, we get the call. So they go in to investigate.
And I guess...
do you want to do what we always do? You want to break down the movie real quick?
I was just going to offer to if you didn't want to.
Go for it.
All right, so I actually wrote this because I think that what IMDb wrote sucked. Because IMDb writes, a rescue crew investigates a spaceship that disappeared into a black hole and has now returned with someone or something new on board. What I called it was, a paramilitary crew is deployed on a dangerous, top-secret, deep-space mission to rescue a ship capable of faster-than-light travel that has disappeared for 7 years, leaving only flayed corpsicles, an infernal radio transmission, and some mean, chunky, gory chili splattered on the walls. What happened to the Event Horizon, and where she was all this time? Her creator, Dr. Weir, wants to know more than anything.
You wrote that?
Yeah, it's going to be in the review that's going to drop in a couple days on the site. But yeah, that was my take on it. IMDb disappointed me.
And they're also, look at this crew as basically the Coast Guard. That's what Paul Anderson wanted them to kind of be. So they're like, they're the people that go out into space and save people. So it's like Kevin Costner in The Guardian diving into water while Snow Patrol plays. These guys are kind of like the Coast Guard of space. So kind of interesting parallel. But you know what I love about this movie? And I think explains why here's my theory about why people are so drawn to this film. Titanic, right? Took forever to film, so it got delayed. So that meant in Paramount's schedule, there was an opening 10 months later. So from when Paramount had figured out the opening, it was 10 months. The script was written. Paul Anderson had the script. There was a lot of storyboards. But they're like, okay, you start shooting in 10 weeks. So he gets with this producer, Jeremy Bolt, who's great on the Event Horizon commentary. He gets with Jeremy Bolt. They somehow land Pinewood, which is where they do all the Harry Potters, the Bond, Star Wars, Eyes Wide Shut, massive, massive stages. And they have 10 weeks to build every set and cast the roles and make the costumes, which is not much time. Well, I mean, so they find the one guy in England who's willing to do it. They start building the sets. The production designer, his name is Joseph Bennett. He also did Deep Blue Sea. Woohoo! And of course they're building sets while they're working, but 10 weeks is nothing. That's like a nothing time. When I've worked on some sets, I've watched them build these things that aren't even the size of that over the course of weeks and weeks and weeks. Now, they shot the film quickly, right? But then they only had like 2 months to edit it and release it in the theaters. So Paul Anderson was 30 years old. He's editing and showing this movie to people at the same time without finished effects. So the focus groups that saw this film were seeing it without special effects. Not everything was done. So he turned in a 2-hour and 10-minute cut. It was way too extreme. Turned in another one. They still thought it was extreme. So it was his third cut that made the cinemas. And a lot of stuff didn't make the cut. So this is a movie that between 10 months went from set building to filming to reshoots to editing to releasing. I mean, that's a nothing timeline. And I think I respect this movie more now knowing it. I mean, it kicked everyone's butt. Like, the director, Paul Anderson, was working 7 days a week. And I think because of that, there's like some really kind of cheeky moments in here. They couldn't think everything through. They had to rush a lot of it. But somehow, I think not by dumb luck, but this 30-year-old guy with this great cast pulled off a really good film that Paramount didn't like. But
his best movie ever, too.
Yeah. Oh, this is by far his best film. But you know what I think? And maybe I'm wrong. I think this movie, he really swung for the fences, and it was such like a stressful experience, and it was such a bomb that he almost didn't go back to that. He went back to like his form. Like, he has a formula now, and he's been very successful at Resident Evil. But now when you see one of his movies, you're like, this is the guy who made Event Horizon? I wonder if this film kind of changed him a little bit in regards to how he shot.
Yeah, it's funny. You don't normally think of someone achieving, I'm just going to say, greatness. I mean, people can say what they want about calling this film art or not, but I don't think normally people would achieve greatness and then decide not to go for it again. Not for fear of not meeting the mark, but by the pragmatic reality of how stressful it was, how much work it was. Yeah, I mean, you can still make really fun films without stressing yourself out.
And Paramount didn't know they were going to get this kind of cut from him. And he said it on the commentary that he's in a really dark place. So the first screening that he turned into people, they explained it as the audiences went from horror to indignation.
Oh, yeah, I think, didn't he say, like, it got so over the top that they basically just disengaged and didn't even, they went from being horrified to just being disgusted by the film and not being horrified anymore.
Yeah, and like, you know, and then also, did you hear the story about how a flamethrower burnt down one of their stages?
Yes.
Their fire effect.
It was so powerful. Yeah. They had this, the only thing they had was too powerful for what they needed.
Yeah, so this is one of those productions, and I don't know, but because of that, like, I think you said this movie reaches greatness. I think it's for the time that it had, the cast that it had, the reshoots that they had to go through, the fact that it's as good as it is a miracle to me. And so, I don't know, I just have a lot more respect for this movie after knowing everything that went behind the scenes. The cinematographer is really good too. Adrian Biddle, he did Princess Bride, Willow, Reign of Fire, The Mummy, The World's Not Enough. So, I mean, there's a lot of talent behind the camera. They even apparently talked to Clive Barker when they were writing the script or like working on the script and doing storyboards.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty neat. That was IMDb. I didn't hear that out of his mouth. But so I guess I talked about the background of the film a lot. Do you want to like jump into the actual film?
Yeah, you know, I'd love to actually start really early on in the film, right after we first see Sam Neill, and he's on this little temporary space station going around the Earth's orbit before he gets on the Lewis and Clark. When we first meet him, there's so many shots in this film that I think are fantastic. Remember, we see him, he's upside down, he's having his coffee, and the film and the camera starts to pan backwards while spinning as we get a wider and wider and wider shot of the space station.
Yeah.
I mean, that was amazing to me.
That shot made a guy quit the industry because he worked so hard on it.
The whole industry?
Yeah, he quit. Because it was so rushed. And the thing is, this is a one more thing. This is a $60 million movie back in 97. I guess they were shooting in 96, let's say. The reason that it was so expensive is because the rush to create everything created a lot of overtime. And so if they would have had a normal schedule, it would have probably cost the same amount and they could have had a lot more. But since it was such a truncated amount of time, once these workers go from 8 hours to 10 hours to 12 hours to 14 hours, and then they come back and they're doing 7 days a week, when you hit that much money, like, that's why this movie's so expensive. So I thought that was pretty interesting. I wanted to tell you that. And that one shot is beautiful. And for 1996, 1997 standards, it looks beautiful.
Oh, God.
And he actually framed it after, Notre Dame. He actually put it into a computer system and molded that. That was his design, Anderson. Like, he wanted that look for the ship.
Yeah, so – and we meet Sam Weir. He has kind of a weird little dream that we don't need to get into yet unless you really want to. But he has like a weird little – not a dream, more like he's just – something's bothering him. And then what? He ends up getting onto Lewis and Clark. He gets rushed into his not cryo sleeper but this aquatic hypersleep by the Lewis and Clark crew that are going to be our protagonists. And then they just like launch out 56 days to the orbit of Neptune to where the Event Horizon has reappeared, this faster-than-light ship, after it had disappeared for 7 years and no one knows why or where it went or any of that.
Well, it's because of the dimensional gateway. You know, point A and point B coexist at the same time. It's a gravity drive. Interstellar did that as well. Sorry. That's all you just...
And, you know, anyone who saw that new Disney trailer for A Wrinkle in Time, where the kids are explaining that the shortest distance between two points is absolute zero. And this has been used in other movies too. This is the first movie where this example ever came up. And they actually talked to like a physicist or a mathematician. And then the producers or the writers were charged to try and explain this on screen. And this just totally worked.
Yeah. They're like, well, it's Paul Anderson's like, people aren't going to want to listen to that. That's why like they picked up the picture of like the scantily clad woman to like break, you know, like, fold it in half and put the pencil through it. So they wanted to like put some pizzazz to it because for some reason Paul Anderson was like, people don't want to listen to this. So they kind of spiced it up to make that kind of set.
What a great scene too. I heard the commentary. I didn't see all the making of, but I heard the commentary and it turns out they were nervous about that scene during the filmmaking because it was the longest continuous scene of just dialogue in the whole movie. And then, but it had so much character. We have Oh gosh, I can't think of his name. Pertree?
Sam Pertree. Sean Pertree is Smith. Then you have
Sean Pertree.
Yep. Then you have Lawrence Fishburne as Captain Miller. Joel E. Richardson as Stark. Kathleen Quinlan. That's a big name. Kathleen Quinlan's Peters. Yeah. Richard T. Jones is Cooper. Jack Noseworthy's Justin. Jason Isaacs. Harry Potter. That kind of fame.
And
DJ. So, I mean, big cast.
These characters, though, in this scene, almost – I won't say all because I can't remember the scene perfectly, but almost all of them had a moment to kind of enrich it with their reactions. They're very different kinds of reactions – stress, sarcasm, skepticism, pragmatism from Captain Miller. But like, you know, Sean Pertree just kind of freaks out about it. He reacts to the, oh, well, that's, you know, so-and-so that's mine. You know, the centerfold fold out that was used. Yeah. And he freaks out and gets up from the table. Like everyone had their moment to first show you how they are. And like after seeing that scene, I can't imagine why you were nervous, but of course I wasn't behind the camera.
Yeah. The crew on the Lewis and Clark, they didn't want to be there. They got pulled from something else to go do a mission they don't know anything about. So there's a lot of hesitation with Sam Neill. And you know what I like the most about Sam Neill's character in this scene? He's very pompous. He's very you can see that he thinks he's like the smartest guy. Like it, I don't know, that scene really sets up his character well as like the smartest guy in the room. And I thought it did a good job with him.
And he wants to be liked, but he's not so self-aware about how he comes off.
Yeah, there we go.
He's clearly, you know, very pleased with himself because why are you here, Dr. Weir? Because I created
him. Yeah, that's what it
like
was.
His hands come up in the air. Yeah. It's like, it's almost like when someone says, welcome to Jurassic Park, their eyes light up, their smile gets a little wider, their hands are in the air when they say it. Yeah. Like I'm doing it right now. Like our listeners can hear my hands in the air. But, I mean, he really wants to be liked. He wants to be understood. We know that he cares a lot about this ship, and we also get a glimmer. Again, earlier, it's very vague. And then in his stasis sleep, when they were on the way to this scene, he has a nightmare about his wife. And it basically comes down to how he should have been there. He has all this guilt. Something horrible happened to her. We don't see what it is yet. Or not something horrible, but, you know, something happened. He's guilty. He's not with her anymore.
Yeah.
So this ship, though, is what created a problem in his personal, his love life and his personal life, because he was obsessed with it. And now he's here and he's happy to be here. He's excited to go find her, as he always calls the event horizon. It's always a her. It's like some dude, like, you know, squeegeeing a rag over his 57 Corvette on weekends in his garage. Yep,
I got a cleaner.
Did Corvettes exist in 57? I just made up car things. I'm not a car person.
I'm sure they did. No, like, and then they receive a single transmission, right? And it's obviously terrible. But these guys are, this is a rescue mission. These guys are called in to go do this. So normally, if you're just like an asteroid cheese farmer, you're like, I'm out of here. These people are speaking Latin, you know, and they're obviously killing each other. But these people are like, we got to go. Like, that's our job.
Well, and they were already there when they first heard it. That's, again, it's so in the dark. I'm going to come back to Alien. It's like when something was discovered and they learned that they were contractually obligated to go, even though it was time to head home. In this case, they just had to go. They had to leave their vacation. And then they're hearing, and you don't know if it's because the transmission is bad, if it's because there's a fire or a breach in the hull, or because the ship is exploding, or because, you know, carnivorous tribbles are eating them alive. You don't know what it is.
Yeah, or Bury Your Dead is performing a song, you know, like some hardcore stuff.
I can't even, you know, it's funny. I've seen this so many times. I can't even imagine what it's like to respond to this radio transmission if you haven't seen the movie.
Yeah.
Like, what is that? What's your reaction to that? Hey, listeners, if you just saw this movie for the first time before this podcast, please tell me what your initial response was to that horrible radio transmission. Did it just sound like white noise?
All right, so then they get to the ship. Sam Neill, or Weir, knows exactly where to go. And you know what I thought was pretty interesting? What was his name? Mr. Cooper. No, not Cooper. Justin. They called him Baby Bear.
Well, so yeah.
But I like that, though. It shows that, like, they're a crew.
It wasn't, and it wasn't just Kathleen Quinlan's character. Someone else said it first.
Yeah, Fishburne said it. Cooper says it. Yeah, like, that's his nickname. Like, I like that. That was, like,
I feel like that was one of the unexplored things in the movie, but maybe when they were writing the characters, they had this notion, because all the characters had a guilt where the ship would later haunt them. And we know what most of the people's are, but we never knew what was haunting Mr. Justin when he had his hellish psychotic episode. And it strikes me that his is probably about abandonment and loss, because he has his mama bear, Kathleen Quinlan. And he tries to, when he goes into his evil zone, he tries to end his own life. He's saying how lonely it is. He was saying, not how horrible, he was talking about how lonely it was in the dark.
I mean, I thought you really looked into this.
Well, I don't know. I just kind of felt it. I guess it doesn't help my viewing that my mother isn't doing well and I lost my dad. It didn't take me to a bad place. It just had me kind of honing in on that. And when we were thinking about the movie again, everyone had their own guilt and only some people's were discussed. And in the commentary, they mentioned Jason Isaacs' fear and guilt had to do with his surgery, with the scar on his chest, which is why Sam Neill did what he did to him later in the movie when he went evil. But they didn't discuss that in the script. In the dialogue, and Mr. Justin's was kind of left in the dark for us too. But so I think that's what that baby bear thing was. I imagine one of the cuts might have had a line of dialogue or a rewrite that maybe separated us as first time viewers from the real meaning to that.
I just saw him as a rookie, and they just kind of looked, you know, called him Baby Bear. Like, he was like one of the youngest on the crew, and it's a way to show that they're lived in.
But he's got a mama bear, but not a papa bear.
But he never calls her mama bear. And everyone else calls them that. So I think it's just like a term of endearment to show that they're a crew.
Oh, it could be that too.
You know how when we worked with Dave, you know, we just called him Shithead.
Aw, and Ragwood.
Yeah, that's right. Guy we worked with at Comic-Cons for years. So they're on the ship. Mr. Justin goes in. He gets sucked into some goo. He gets blown back. A bunch of damages happen. And, I mean, is there anything else you want to cover in there?
Well, so, you know, when we first announced that we were going to do this for a podcast episode, one of my friends who didn't like the movie apparently that much actually threw a question out, not really as a listener question. He said, here's my problem with this movie. What possessed Sam Neill, and at what point does he become possessed? And this is a really – this question has like 89 answers. I thought about it a lot. But the movie – first shows us, in my opinion, when they go to the core, the magnetic drive, what they call the gravity drive, mm-hmm. right? The thing that does the special travel. And when they are leaving the room after he's there, it's totally safe. This, that, and the other. I'm Sam Neill. I'm trying to do a Sam Neill voice. When they are leaving, there's a and it closes in on his eye as he's looking at it before he walks out. And I feel like that's the first time the film decides to tell us that the ship is starting to attune to him, connect to him, possess him, whatever, insert your word, right? And but it might have been happening before he was ever there.
Yeah, a combination of things maybe, but Quinlan also had those eyes too when she died. She had the reflection of that ship in her eyes, and she was infected as well. But then you look at Jolie Richardson, Cooper – and Lawrence Fishburne, they never had that. So maybe he was just attuned to Sam Neill. Maybe the ship kind of knew him. But Quinlan got that too.
Did the ship call him back?
Maybe.
I don't know. That's a totally different conversation, I guess. But I like these scenes. It was that was the first time we got to see our rescue engineer. I can't remember the character's name.
Cooper?
He saves Justin and... And then they're all freaked out and they're like, nobody goes in this room, you know, whatever, with the, why were there spikes on the wall in the room with the gravity drive?
Yeah, that was crazy. I think he just wanted like a real techno, like not punk. He just wanted like a punk kind of vision, like a very, That was all Anderson's idea. And it was kind of funny, though, and I liked when Fishburne was just basically like, no, no one's going in there. And Sam Neill's like, no, no, they got, like, triple magnetic walls. Like, it's fine. I'm like, no, I don't care about triple magnetic walls.
And that thing looked gorgeous. Yeah, it looked elaborate and gorgeous.
That set is actually where they build all the massive Bond layers. So on the Bond films from back in the day, whenever there was a huge, massive layer, like in a volcano, that's where they built the sets. And the interesting thing is it was freezing at the time. So that was just like a tin roof. And everybody in there was just freezing in that room. And also anytime it rained or noises, they couldn't really film. So a lot of the dialogue in this movie is actually ADR'd, which I find to be pretty interesting. So that's ADR's recording after the fact. I read an Empire interview where everything was almost thrown out. And then Lawrence Fishburne's in a microphone going, ah, ooh, ah, like all the noises. So I thought that was kind of cool.
And not just that, the ship, you know, from when they first arrived to the Event Horizon to whenever they show like a shot of just the ship floating in space before we get back to what's going on inside. This ship looked the design was really cool. I thought that even today, the effects looked very crisp to me. And I mean, when you get closer, it's very detailed. Like it's all very impressive to me.
Yeah, especially for 97 and a 30-year-old directing it with, you know, a very short shooting schedule.
Yeah, super impressed with this.
And they lit the set on fire.
By accident.
All right, so how about we do this? We're going to take a quick break. We're going to go put out a fire that Paul Anderson started with a fire flamethrower that's way too large, that flipped on its side, burnt almost everything in the studio, and we'll be back. Welcome back to Movies, Films, and Flicks. I just pulled my best Kurt Russell backdraft mode, and you pulled your best John Travolta Ladder 49 mode, and we put that fire out.
I just leapt 60 feet to another building with my prosthetic leg.
Yeah, but you have two legs. You were holding one. That's what makes it even more.
I was doing an air guitar, and then I jumped with the grounded foot. Like The Rock.
Oh, brother. All right, so we got a couple listener questions.
Sure, sure. I want to save some for the end, but we have, why is Lawrence Fishburne's captain's chair so uncomfortable looking and over-engineered? This question, by the way, comes from return listener question Alex Vorkov from Twitter.
Now, I do know that Fishburne loved this chair. He was like a huge fan of it. But the problem is they built it so he could look at everything. But it just didn't work because it was on a hydraulic set, so the set it would shake. So they ended up losing control of the chair, and it just kind of floated everywhere. So I guess they kind of meant it to be a chair where he could look at everything, where he could look to his left, right, do all that kind of stuff. That was the captain's chair. But they just didn't have enough time to make it fully functional, and it ended up looking like a little skinny chair.
So it's interesting because, like, I know what they mean – too, in some respects, because when it moves up and then it stops, it has like a little rickety rock for a second.
Yeah.
Like a little jilt. It looks, however, very cool. And I like that it's central. I like that the captain's chair looks different than I feel like other captain's chairs look. And I didn't think about this until about my second watch in the last several days. But it doesn't look comfortable. It actually looked like his knees were really close together, like you were on an airplane.
Yeah, I mean, he seems like the type of guy.
I imagine Fishburne.
I'll go for it.
I was just gonna say, I imagine Fishburne liked it because he got to be like the Shatner in this Psy horror.
And he seems like the type of guy that wouldn't complain. Like he hates it, but he's like, I'm the captain. I'm not.
It's a
complain.
Neat chair.
No, I mean,
it's a fancy chair.
It's just tough to work. I think they got a little overly ambitious with it on their schedule. I mean, that's a tough thing to really work on the set. So the idea was there, they built it there, but it looks, I wouldn't want that chair. I'd just take a lawn chair, put it in the middle, hang out.
Yeah. And we actually have a few more listener questions that I'm going to save so that they don't interrupt the pace of our conversation. But we have actually three more, including another comment from Alex later on after we finish our discussion. But so, Mark, this film, we're reaching the point where things have started to go wrong. At first, it just looked like kind of a technical mishap that affected Mr. Justin. And, you know, we didn't think that there was evil afoot. But later enough things start happening that evil abounds. Like, which of these evil things that start creeping up did you like or dislike or favor?
I don't think I ever got into, like, the crew being taken over so much. I just kind of liked the atmosphere, and I liked Fishbird's character, and I liked how they were trying to survive it. But I think what hit me the most for this is not particularly who the evil or, you know, whatever hell hit. It's just the utter hopelessness of it. But I like that they're still fighting it. And I like that when you see these scenes of what happened to the prior crew, that's what sticks with me the most, is what happened to the prior crew.
The flash visions of hell. You know, that goes back to when they were first entering the from the Lewis and Clark, the Event Horizon. And they make it out. I don't remember if that was the main deck, the captain's deck or whatever, where you see in those little alcoves the gore chili splattered on the wall when the lights flicker. Like that scene to me, that when you see that in the flashes of light, I mean, and they're like skeletons stuck in dry gore against these alcoves in the captain's deck or whatever. And God, like, it's that and the visions of hell. Those are the things that I used to always remember most about this movie.
I love when Fishburne's like, this place is a tomb. And then
this place is a
tomb. And then the one thing, like, the eyes, what happened to his eyes? And they're saying, oh, maybe decompression. But then Sean Pertree's like, oh, maybe an animal did it. I'm like, there's no – I was like, come on.
You know, he was flashing forward to his dog soldiers days.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, maybe the wolves. But, I mean, I guess he's brainstorming, and I guess it's logical to think of everything. But when I heard that, I was like, oh, brother. But, yeah, no, I liked that even as some of these characters were turning, everyone was trying, like, Baby Bear, they were really trying to save him. Like, this guy was really affected. He got actually sucked into the portal. He wanted to die, but they saved him. I don't know. I thought that was pretty cool, like, that they were really going out of their way for each other as a crew.
And you know, this comes back to like them just doing their job and dealing with their horrible situation. When Mama Bear, I'm just going to start calling her that. When Mama Bear is like, you know, Justin woke up. He's made his way into the airlock. He's going to launch himself out. There's something wrong with him. Basically, I'm paraphrasing. And you know, you're getting to Lawrence Fishburne, who's out with Cooper outside, and Cooper's doing repairs on the side of the ship. Cooper's like, okay, that's me. Like, I'm the rescue guy. And Lawrence Fishburne's like, no, I need you here. Like, this is what you do. I don't do this. I guess I got to go save him. And Lawrence Fishburne just goes and, you know, it didn't sound like confident in the sense like, I'm a good guy who can figure out how to save people. It's just like, no, you need to be here to save us all.
Yeah. And also, they were going to run out of air in 20 hours. We didn't mention that after the first explosion.
Right.
So, and I also like the scene where Cooper sees something. And Sam Neill's like, oh, nothing happened. And then Lawrence Fishburne's like, Mr. Cooper says he saw something. I believe him. That was cool.
Yeah.
Fishburne's really good in this movie.
Yeah, Sam Neill is always like, he's always rationalizing, I'm going to say this, like, on the side of the ship.
Yeah.
On the side. But of course, at the same time, something supernatural is happening to them. And in these movies, they don't believe walking into the movie that supernatural things happen. So he's just rationalizing, oh yeah, you know, there could have been expansion and contraction in the metal that could have affected time, space, and the gravity drive. It could have created disorientation. So he's always rational. And of course it pisses off everyone. Cooper's like, what the fuck are you saying? You know, like he gets pissed off. And that was an interesting dynamic, because every time it happens, I got irritated at Sam Neill, at Dr. Weir. But when I thought about it, I'm like, I see what's going on here and it's fine, but it still irritated me.
Yeah. And no, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And do you mind if I bust a couple production notes for you here real quick?
Bust those notes.
All right. So Jolie, what was her character's name? Gosh, I need to remember this. Jolie Richardson Stark. There's a weird hat on her. At one point in the commentary, the director's like, I think we got the hat wrong. I don't know. I just love that they got her hat wrong. And then, what do you, so This is also really interesting for this film. So he was known as a very fast-moving director, Paul Anderson, but he really wanted to mimic Kubrick. So what'd you think about all the symmetrical sets that were here? And like,
I mean, they felt very, very aesthetically pleasing, but at the same time, not all of them. I don't really have an eye for this, but not all of them. But some of them you start to notice, especially when it went from one person to another person. You'd notice it, and it almost felt curated. It almost felt more staged, not fake, not – I don't know. But I'd notice it. It felt like there was a deliberate appeal or goal about it. And I don't even know – I don't have the words. But, yeah, sometimes I noticed it, and it the symmetry looked very cool, but it didn't look so natural.
Gotcha. It's kind of interesting. I feel like he made his best film trying to like – he really drew from all of his influences, but now he just makes Paul Anderson films. It's kind of like an interesting dynamic how his best film was him drawing inspiration from all of his – I don't know. I think that's a pretty cool dynamic. But yeah, getting back to the movie, you have Weir being a pain in the butt. You have Cooper fixing the airlock, and then you have the first visions of Stark and Mama Bear – see the first unfiltered clips of what happened to the first crew.
Oh my God. This is one of those things where like when you see the extended version on YouTube, and you can do that, by the way, see like the longer version. It doesn't look as cool because you have time to focus in on it. But boy, the flashes, I think they're great. You know, the maggots, the screaming, these people are basically banging each other to death while murdering each other with devices or their hands or choking. It's this very macabre thing.
You see enough of it to infer what's going right on, but you don't get enough of it to actually see. Like if they left the camera on it for 4 seconds, it probably might have become a little comical. But since right, it's just so blasted at you, you're like, what did I just see? Like he brought up a good point, like aliens. Like all right, so that movie Psycho. People were, when they walked out of it, they just thought it was the glorious film they'd ever seen in their lives. But it's really not. Yeah, yeah. So like some goes down the shower drain, but that's it. But people in their heads were like, there was blood everywhere. So you watch this scene and just because you see enough of it, you build it up so much in your head. And I gotta say, hearing Lawrence Fishburne go, fuck this ship. Like,
He says that a little later. Oh, he goes, we're leaving.
He says that first, actually. I'm sorry. Yeah, he goes, we're leaving. That's such a great response. Like,
and
out.
He's calm. You know that in his head, it's like the duck's feet under the water, but at the top, it just looks like a calm duck. Like, we're leaving. I'm not going to finish that sentence. We only get so many F-bombs in an episode before iTunes rates us differently. But so and then he's freaking out, and then Weir goes from what I will call rationalizing and pragmatizing in defense of the ship and physics to the supernatural stuff to he just turns weird on us.
Yeah, you can't leave. It won't let you.
She won't let you.
And then he runs away.
Like he goes straight up Hellraiser Hannibal Lecter on us.
Yeah. And then he sets up an explosion. That blows up the Lewis and Clark. But my favorite piece of acting in this film is when Pertree realizes that he's going to die. Yeah. And there's that look that they just keep the camera on his face. But just that's why you bring in real actors for reactions like that. That was a powerful shot, I thought, on Pertree when he blew up. So you have the Lewis and Clark blown up. Everybody's on the event horizon.
I'm reminded, actually, even though it's a more cheeky, funny scene, of right before Gary Oldman explodes in The Fifth Element. It's one of those scenes where it's like you couldn't have had this in script notes and expected it to come out like this.
Yeah, no, yeah, for sure. I mean, I like that Pertree, man. Watch Dog Soldiers too. That's a good movie.
He's one of those people who I don't think a lot of people will recognize his name, and I stuttered on it a few times, but he always does such a great job. He just doesn't have, I guess, the look or the presence to get those, you know, those singular lead roles. But he's great. Everything he touches, I love.
So we got, what else is he? He's one of those guys where you're like, oh, yeah, that's where he's in.
That's just, it's like he's one of those actors. It's like there are a lot of actors where if you say name one of their films, people would normally struggle to do it. But then when you show them a scene like, oh, right, that guy.
Yeah.
That like, dude. That's him. Except he's the that guy who really brings something special instead of just being good because he has a look or something. He does very well. But so now things are good. Poor guy explodes. And yeah, he has a wonderful face. I think that Anderson was even saying like they were just going to cut it, but he did such a good job.
Yeah. They just left it on his face.
On that expression. And so now things are going bad, and Lawrence Fishburne knows that, or Captain Miller, that is, knows that Dr. Weir is going a little crazy, and he starts warning people. And now Weir, is fighting kind of for the ship's interest, and it's getting weird. I can't remember who the very next victim was, but
Quinlan.
Quinlan. Well, she died. The ship takes care of her.
Yeah. But she's the next because everyone else is still in play. Because Baby Bear is in cryo because of his injuries. They saved him from going out the airlock. Jolie Cooper's out working. Jolie's – I forget where she was with. She's hanging out. Then Mama Bear, Pertree, got those air cores. And then she got led away by her child and her legs snapped.
Oh, when she fell down there to the gravity drive.
She hit like every stair. Deck,
whatever. Dude, like her bones kind of like ripped out of her pants in a few places. You don't see a whole lot, but I was just like, my eyes widened. Like I was imagining that. Like that was brutal.
Oh my. Yeah.
Yes.
And then she hits, her legs pop out. Actually, no, Weir finds her. No, I'm sorry. Weir finds her before he goes crazy. Because remember, he sees her and he's like, oh, my gosh. And he feels terrible for her, Sam
That's
Neill.
Right.
But then I love the interaction where he runs off and then, he's like, we can't leave her. Weir says it. And then Captain Miller goes, I have no intention of leaving her, Doctor. I will take the Lewis and Clark to a safe distance and then I will launch TAC missiles at the event horizon until I'm satisfied she's vaporized. F this ship. That's a logical response.
Yeah, and again, cool and calm all the time. The duck's legs are going crazy, but he's always calm on the surface.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Remember on the commentary, these two had a hard time kind of acting together because Fishburne knocks out his takes in the first three, but then Sam Neill needs a lot like time to get into his character.
Yeah, that was interesting. Yeah, so it's like Lawrence Fishburne prepares a lot, and yeah, he degenerates when they keep trying to change it. And Sam Neill likes to find his character in the scene. That's really – and they even brought up, I think, that's why they you usually don't have them both in the shot at the same time.
Yeah, single shots.
Yeah. That's actually really – because I would have, if I were to guess, I would have actually guessed maybe the opposite.
Yeah, it's, you know, I was going to say old school actors, but Sam Neill's older than Fishburne, I believe. But people at that time, you know, there are like Terrence Stamp, Michael Caine, a lot of these actors, Christopher Lee, they're just one or two. So maybe it's like an old school type of thing where you just, I did my line. I'm an actor. I don't need 47 takes. So I wonder if that's. So
you got what you're going to get.
Yeah.
But yeah, so, I mean, Sam Neill gets evil. He pulls, I don't know, he pulls a little Hellraiser shenanigans on poor Jason Isaacs, Dr. DJ.
Oh, yeah.
He disembowels him, hangs him by hooks.
Yeah.
And his guts are out on the table. And
that's crazy. You know, in the NC-17 cut, they left his guts in him so he could still be alive. And they had a dialogue scene with him just at the table.
I would have loved that.
So it's like he's completely – everything's out of his body, but everything's still attached, and they're still talking to him. So they had to cut all that.
Oh, I'd love to see that.
And like lifts his head and guts are everywhere. Yeah, that one felt very quick for me because I like Jason Isaacs. That kill was pretty quick.
Yeah. It didn't get a lot of draw, but I mean it wasn't just like a random throwaway slasher kill, but I agree. He didn't get what he deserved. Like Kathleen Quinlan, you saw the whole thing from start to finish, you know, her getting into the fear zone, her, you know, being fooled by the ship, the terror of realization, and then the outcome. So she got this very drawn out resolved, is what I'd like to call it, kill scene. And Jason Isaac, and again, and I like that they went for his he rips open his shirt and you see that scar from when he had, like, I guess, open heart surgery or something. And, you know, I just assume that that's where Sam Neill made his first incision line with the bone saw.
Chest burster came out of him and then he fixed it.
Right.
How long would that take to hang up his body like that?
That looks like it was an elaborate job. I got to tell you, I don't know. Even if you were as strong as The Rock, I don't know how one man does that without, because you can't hook one hook. There were like 12 hooks in him. You can't hook one hook and then go reach for another hook. It will rip.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like he had to have the ship's spectral minions that I'm inventing. You know, the macabre gnomes appeared and helped him.
Oh, yeah.
Like little evil doozers from Fraggle Rock. Because there's no way that one dude did that. I don't care if he do have evil strength.
Would you say he probably had a hell of a time putting that thing up?
A hell of a time. An ex in Ferris time. An in Ferris time. But what was it? So that happens. Eventually, there's this really drawn-out scene that I wasn't overly impressed with that resulted in Sam Neill getting jettisoned out of the ship.
Oh, yeah. Everyone hated that scene. In the commentary, Anderson's like, this is crap. So they walk into the main cabin. Sam Neill sewed his eyes shut.
Because where we're going, we won't need eyes to see.
So he's hanging people up. How long does it take to sew your eyes shut?
Well, apparently not. Wait, don't you need to see to do the stitches? Like in the beginning, right, you can close one eye and you stitch it shut. But once you are doing the second eye, like you're going fully by feeling. This has got to take a while.
Yeah.
This is another thing that's not a one-man job where he got hell power.
So you're saying there's hell gnomes helping
him. I think that they're little evil doozers. The macabre gnomes that the Event Horizon found from another world that she traveled to. Yeah.
So in between, the Event Horizon's just been traveling to different planets?
Different worlds. Who knows, man? I mean, if we're saying that this went to hell and hell is a place, then like what other places are there? It could have been all over the place.
Was it hell?
Well, they kind of loosely say that she's gone, you know, beyond something that we're capable of, that of flibbity flobbity flip, and we're getting these visions.
Gotcha.
But I don't think they were that specific, actually. I might just be inventing that. After seeing the movie a couple dozen times, I've developed my own mythology, perhaps, of the movie.
No, yeah, you're close with this, man. Like, there's some things in here, like with Baby Bear, I never even thought about. So, it's good. I just like that.
But they do specifically say, save yourself from hell in Latin.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
And we do see people fornicating to death while murdering each other, sort of. And, like, I mean, it seems hella. They could have just gone to some. Oh, you know what? At some point, they even say she went to a place of pure chaos.
Yeah.
I think that was the line.
Was that Tampa?
It could have been Tampa. It could have been Tampa. It's.
So, I mean, it's just, I like that she's traveling around doing evil. That kind of makes me happy. But, yeah, so going back to that scene, like, the glass gets smashed open, right? And everyone's falling out into space. Sam Neill gets sucked away, which is pretty anticlimactic. But then basically all Paul Anderson did was just shoot fire extinguishers at Julie Richardson and Lawrence Fishburne. And then they
had to, like, the gas escape or whatever.
And then they just had to crawl on the ground.
Yeah, that was a dull scene, and that's cool. And then
I think he gave it like a 4 out of 10. Like the director was like, "Yeah, I didn't like that."
I mean, even Legends of the Fall had some slow parts.
Yeah. And also there's a scene in this movie during the commentary. Anderson's like, "That's a bad shot." He's like, "I did not do a good one with that."
I like that though. You know, it's so like just honest. It's like he said other times, like, I don't know how I made this look this beautiful. Like, and then later, yeah, that's a bad shot. He's all over the place. He just seems very honest and just, he's really pleased with what he made and he's really, you know, just practice. He knows what he did and didn't do well. It's cool. And he's not trying to hide it. Some people hide it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah,
they,
yeah.
Like, they won't admit it. They'll be like, this is wonder. Like, they want you to think it's wonderful because they say, this is wonderful. And you're just, like, looking at, I don't know, something stupid, like a dog eating dog food, and they're calling it art. Yeah. I don't know. I just went to a weird place here.
Save me. I don't know what just happened, Mark.
No, I think it's true. Some people don't want to admit that they've had a bad shot. And I think they definitely compliment the film a lot, but they also like Jeremy Bolt's talking about all the influences and it's kind of annoying him. But, and then, you know, they're talking about the mistakes they made, how things don't look real. So it's like, it's the best of both worlds in here. And I appreciate that. Like, he's willing to knock himself down, but he's also like, I love that. I would do that, dude. If I made a sweet ass movie and I'm doing the DVD commentary and there's a great shot, I'm going to be like, yeah, that was my idea.
This was, you know, like, awesome.
I was like, I didn't film it. You know, a lot of people worked on it, but that was my idea. I don't know, man. I don't know.
During the DVD commentary, you hear a as you open a Coors Light to that scene.
Oh, yeah. Now, you know, in the original cut, so what happens is the ship blows up. It's down to Cooper, Stark, and Lawrence Fishburne. And Cooper and Stark go to one end of the event horizon to take off because Weir has scheduled it to go to hell, I believe. And it's up to Fishburne to separate the ship from, blow up the middle part. So then the two end, it's like a dumbbell. Think of a dumbbell. And then he wants to blow up the middle part. But then he gets into a fight with Sam Neill, who in the original, it was just a Burning Man. Sam Neill never came back in the first one. And audiences hated it.
But now he's back because the ship brought me back.
Yeah.
She wouldn't let me go.
And he's in that crazy prosthetics where he's all cut up and it was freezing. So he was like really cold, but he couldn't go next to the heaters because his makeup would melt.
Can we take a moment to appreciate that, like, while Anderson acknowledges a bad shot, the ship is like, oh, and I made Sam Neill so evil that he sewed his eyes shut. I didn't like that. So the ship brought him back with his eyes.
Yeah.
Like, the ship disapproved. Yeah. Like, Samuel, you went, like, full crazy. I needed you at, like, an 8, and yeah, you went to, like, an 11. So here are your eyes.
It's like you join a biker gang and you go too far.
I'm going to make you look like Pinhead before the wounds were cauterized and he got his nails.
Yeah. I like that idea.
And naked.
Naked. Yeah. So what I'm going to do, Samuel, is you're getting your eyes back and we're taking off your clothes.
Right.
Like, oh, great. And they get all the blood flowing around, the, you know, the big blood geysers, the fights, Lawrence Fishburne on fire. The ending.
It was an over the top scene that remains really fun. It felt like they were trying to do a little too much for me. And yet it was just, it's still very satisfying though, because it's so over the top. Because this is where, like, Sam Neill gets full tilt, caught in his own grandeur of infernal power.
Yeah, he starts monologuing.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, I'm going to kill you, but you're going to hear these 2,000 words before I kill you.
Yeah. And he looked cool. And then, what, Lawrence Fishburne gets a hold of that pipe and he starts whapping him in the head with it.
And he catches it because it didn't hurt him anyway.
Yeah. And then good old Fish blows up the ship. And you know what's kind of crazy to me is, the three survivors are Baby Bear, Stark, and Cooper. Would you have predicted that when you first watched this film?
I would have guessed based on the premise, well, especially the way I read the premise, that everyone died. But other than that, I don't know. I would have gone for like a Mama Bear and maybe just like the least expected dude. Like maybe someone like Cooper, but I'm not saying I would have guessed that. But like, yeah, I would have imagined a sympathetic character and someone who you wouldn't expect.
Cooper got lucky because he was on the outside of the ship the whole time.
But don't worry, he got launched into space.
Oh, though, yeah, right? He did.
But when they were shooting the rivet gun that created the pressure rift that sucked out Sam Neill with his eyes sewn shut before he got his eyes back. That's such a weird thing to say. And then rescue engineered himself. He was flying out away and he charged up his oxygen tank and used it to project himself or whatever back at the ship. Here I come, motherfucker.
That was awesome. Like, characters who survived, it wasn't the ending. I never would have picked these three. Like, if they gave me money and they're like, hey, pick who survives, I wouldn't have gotten this right.
Can I say, even when I originally thought, because, you know, probably the first 10 times I saw this, or even maybe just six, I always thought that Cooper was done. Like, I thought he was dead. You know, he was going to go out into space and die. But every time that guy has lines, do you not smile?
Yeah.
Like, even when he was panicking, before you knew, if this is your first time watching it, before you knew he was going to save himself, he's like, oh my God. Like, but the way he freaks out, there's just something about it. There's like a spastic charisma to this guy.
They've almost done it before. So he's like in this situation. He's like, I've probably been in the same before.
Right. But maybe not as dire.
Yeah, exactly. But it was like, this was a good crew. Like, these people knew what they were doing. If they were against like a jerky alien, I think they would have won. And that's what the script originally was. Then Paul Anderson's like, nope, we are doing a haunted house in space. That's what we're going to do. And he got his way and the script got changed around.
I still think it would have been cool if I saw them fighting that gelatinous monster Calvin from Life.
No, oh, man, they would have done really well. I feel like Fishburne would have. I don't think Calvin could have taken the burn. In this movie, do you?
The burn.
Everyone calls him Fish. Like, everyone's like, yeah, Fish Man, but I call him the burn.
Feel the burn.
I mean, he killed the Burning Man.
Is it funny that, like, Feel the Burn went to, like, this really calm, reserved old politician, and yet Fish went to this young, like, calm, cool, under pressure ship captain fighting space hell?
He's like, man, if it wasn't Burn Fish, like, he wishes his last name was Burn Fish.
Like, this is Lawrence Fishburne versus Hell Space. Like, it's, and he's just calm. He's calm, dude. You cannot freak him out until you show him visions of his buddy that protocol dictated that he watch burn to death in a past mission, and that was his little guilt thing. And then he sees his buddy. It turns out to be Sam Neill disguising himself as his buddy, and they both have eyes.
And then remember that line where Fishburne was like, I'd rather die. And he hated that line, and he would always say it fast and always screwed over Paul Anderson. So he'd be like, I'd rather die. And so when you hear him saying that, that's the slowest take that Anderson could do. So Fishburne in this movie didn't even want to be like, you know, I could die. I'd rather die. Like, I thought that was pretty funny. He was just a cool, reserved, calm guy. He would have taken out Calvin, I think. They would have become friends. Yeah. They would have become friends. Hey, so we got a couple more questions, right, that talk more about this movie?
We do.
Awesome. You want to – we'll jump into them?
Okay, we got a couple more. The first one is more of a comment, but it offers a lot of reflection. It's, again, from Alex Vorkov on Twitter, and he writes in a statement, Event Horizon did Hellraiser in space better than Hellraiser did Hellraiser in space. And he's referring to Hellraiser 4, which came out 1 year earlier in 1996, where it was actually a chronological anthology of Hellraiser stories that were all linked. And the third one took place in the future in space with the puzzle box, etc. And this is a really funny line because, like, if you were to give the tagline of this movie, I'd probably call it Hellraiser in Space. And Hellraiser in Space wasn't very awesome.
Yeah, you just can't go to space with a character that's been established already. Leprechaun in space, Jason in space. If you're going to take a character to space, it needs to be the first film.
You know what's funny is that Leprechaun in Space was also 1996.
Really?
Leprechaun in Space was part four. Hellraiser in Space was part four. They were both released in 1996, 1 year before this. And then this comes in and it just wipes the floor with them. And then, of course, you have three movies that take true horror to space over the course of 2 years. And then just 4 years later in 2001, Jason X comes out. And while I think it is a gloriously entertaining bad movie, it is a horrible Friday the 13th movie.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's some very fun shots in Jason X. But you got to give credit to Hellraiser for allowing Event Horizon to be so great because Paul Anderson loved the Hellraiser films.
You know, I feel like, but you know, he did it the way that it should be done. He took all the things that he loved about Hellraiser and its connections to hell, and then put that story on a spaceship. Hellraiser 4 was like, dude, we're going to take Hellraiser to space. How can we make Hellraiser more spacey? And it all fell flat. Like, it's no, like they tried. Hellraiser in space actually tried to change the style and do, oh, well, what's a space thing that we can integrate into the way someone, you know, dies to Pinhead? You know, like it did, same thing with Leprechaun. This is why these movies were so bad. This movie is just like, this happens to be on a spaceship.
Yeah, Event Horizon's not really a space movie. Obviously, it's in space, but it's more of like a haunted house.
Right, yeah, they don't rely on it being in space so much. It may as well have been a cabin in the woods.
Yeah.
Where you can be propelled by your jetpack or whatever away from it. But still, yeah, it's all the problems, all the things that came up. Like you mentioned that was in the commentary, right? Yeah, he was going for the haunted house style, and you could feel that. This was just the way that hell was influencing them, not here's the clever little tropes that we can mix up.
What did you think? So speaking of hell, what do you think about the ending? Did Jolie Richardson Stark take the ship with her, or is she crazy?
That's one of if I just trust the chronology of the scenes, I think that she's just, you know, forever going to be haunted by it. And then she was really saved because then they give us the, oh, phew scene later. Like, oh, okay, that was just a bad, you know, stasis dream where it was Sam Neill rescuing her. But, you know, the other thing is that there are things – I mentioned this earlier. There are things about this movie that hint to me, that suggest to me that maybe there's a little bit of a time-space thing going on because, again, Sam Neill was being haunted by the same – he had the guilt, right, before he even left Earth's orbit. And then he had it again – in his stasis sleep, and in that nightmare his wife already was missing the eyes.
Yeah,
like, what, it's one thing to feel guilty that your wife committed suicide because you were an absentee, maybe you were having relationship marital problems that we weren't seeing, right, while he was developing, obsessing over the creating the ship. But why the eyelessness? Why the element of horror? Is it not horror enough to realize that your loved one killed herself? Like, they added that, and it was maybe suggestive to me that there might have been a pull of the ship, that maybe this was all a cycle, maybe this is all their hell, and that they will relive this, and that at the end she thinks she's leaving but she's still in her hell, and in the beginning we thought they were going to it but they were already in their hell.
Jeez Louise.
Sorry, this is what happens when you watch a movie like every year for 20 years.
No, I love it, man.
I've written my Iliad and my Odyssey.
No, that's why we work well, though, is because I think about the production aspects and all that kind of stuff. Then you dig deep into the theory of the film.
And I realize, like, this is like a far reach. But again, like, I feel like the breadcrumbs are there that one could put together this notion. I'm sure there are other notions one can put together as well. But this is just a narrative that I have created for the overarching story of what's going on and the ship's influence. And it haunts you after you leave, but it was haunting you before you were there. And why was it already haunting you? Because you all already did things that you were guilty about, right? Mm-hmm. These people were all haunted by things they felt so guilty about. Maybe this was their punishment. That got a little deep,
yeah.
But I loved it. I mean, this movie, and what's interesting is that as creepy as this movie gets at times, when it ends, and then they play what almost just sounds like Mortal Kombat music, right? When it ends, they throw on the credits music.
It's by those guys who made
Prodigy.
Yeah,
the Prodigy.
Did
music,
you know?
Right?
Did you know? Like, he said that in the commentary. Did you know what I was singing right there? And there's a crocodile in that video.
But when this ends, I don't feel like I feel at the end of a Hellraiser movie or at the end of a Texas Chainsaw movie. I feel like I feel not quite, but close to, like, after a Scream movie, I feel like, man, that was kind of fun, even though it was heavy at times. Like, it doesn't linger on me. It doesn't make me feel down. It doesn't make me feel like, whoa. I feel like it's a fun experience that's just has a lot of depth.
Yeah, it's, you know, I guess if we're talking about, like, the fun house, haunted house, like, if you go on a Gravitron, it spins around and makes you sick. That's like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. This is like going on a, this is a fun roller coaster. And then you get off and you're like, that was good. I want to do it again.
You know, from a filmmaking perspective, Mark, if they did what a few movies have done, where when it ends, the screen just goes black and it has silent credits, I wonder if I'd react differently to it.
Yeah, it's a good call.
Because instead, you'd just be like thinking like, whoa, wait, did she get saved? Whereas when it ends with the Prodigy music, it's kind of energizing.
I wonder if that was a studio note.
And I feel like...
because everyone just left this movie depressed. So they're probably like, we need something. We need like... boop-a-doo-doo-ba-doo-doo-doo.
Oh my god, that's the funky shit!
Yeah, or like play some bloopers at the end, you know?
Oh my god, I'd love to see bloopers from this.
Just so people don't leave this just feeling like they just got punched right in the face.
So that actually brings me to the next question. And we mentioned this all the way at the beginning of the pod. Player One, love the name, with Ready Player One coming out later this year. But Player One, who is at Retrobotic,
oh, wait,
with a K.
I'm sorry to do this, but Danny S. Warren wrote something good, too. I know I already said the quote, but it's such a great quote. Do you want to do it again?
You go right ahead, man.
All right, so Danny S. Warren on Twitter, he wrote, this movie has one of my favorite quotes in response to the Supernatural, and I already said it, I wrecked it for him, but I gotta do it. I have no intention of leaving her. Doctor, I will take the Lewis and Clark to a safe distance, and then I'll launch TAC missiles at the event horizon until I'm satisfied she's vaporized. F this ship. Like, what a great line. So.
That's one of those, like, when you hear a line like that, and Lawrence Fishburne throughout the movie had his moments of calm, cool, collected under pressure, but that's like the certified badass stamp right there.
Yeah.
And when he says, bunk this, I don't want to say it too many times, but, you know, like, F this ship. Like, he says it assertively without really raising his voice, but while sort of raising his voice. Yeah. But he won't yell. He won't yell. He's just looking at the screen, adjusting the timing of that little bomb thing that will separate the corridor.
Yeah, it's a cool moment. That also adds some levity to the film. So there's a lot of bleakness to it, but then there's some like also, you know, hokier elements. There's some comedy to it. So it's not like a total drag on your soul.
Yeah.
But sorry to interrupt. I know I took your Retrobotic.
Retrobotic with a K. Player One asks, are there any plans to release a director's cut or uncut version at some point? And you know the true answer to this. Like, I felt like I've gone on Amazon several times looking for this, thinking that I'd find something that was out of print that I'd have to spend $80 on if I wanted it. And I don't see anything. I don't see a foreign release. I see nothing. Why is this?
There will not be. And so what happened was...
wait, there will not? Like, ever?
So in 2017, they said that there will not be. So according to the commentary and what they said... so basically what happened was when they shot this movie, he turned in the first draft. Paramount was not a fan. So he had to recut a lot of stuff. And this is before Blu-rays were really big. I mean, I got my first Blu-ray, I believe, in 99. So, you know, they're still kind of like, I think maybe Laserdiscs were out. Maybe Blu-rays were getting a foothold in here, but they didn't know much about extras. There wasn't all these extras in the film. So all this cut material, the extra, 30, 40 minutes that they cut from the film just got tossed aside. So like there's no avenue for it to be released. Eventually, once everyone started loving this film and wanting to see a director's cut, and there is some stuff on the DVD, but it's all like VHS and they can't make it look great. The effects aren't finished. There is some more blood. There is some more gore. They found a bunch of this footage in a salt mine in Transylvania.
A salt mine? And why was it in a salt mine in Transylvania?
And a lot of the footage they couldn't use. They've only been able to find some of the footage. A lot of it only exists as video, so they can't put it on anything else. They couldn't find the footage for various shots. I mean, it's just basically the footage just isn't usable. And because at the time, Paramount was just like, you know, we're not going to use it for anything. We're not going to use a director's cut. And it, this isn't, I don't know. I know Blade Runner, various films have had director's cuts, but they just, I think the reaction to it was so strong. They just kind of cast it aside. It kind of bombed in theaters. So I think they said, you know, much like Lawrence Fishburne said, F this ship. I think Paramount was like, F this movie. And when they tried to reassemble director's cuts, I mean, this stuff was in a Transylvanian salt mine. So there are no plans as of now to release a director's cut for this film.
Because they just don't, literally don't have the footage.
Yeah. Now, on IMDb, if you look at the facts for it, they kind of break down what some of the footage is. So, I mean, that's pretty close, but I heard nothing out of it. I've read so many interviews for this movie about director's cuts, so the stuff on IMDb, I don't know if it's true. But there is on IMDb breaking down what the shots would be if the footage wasn't in a Transylvanian salt mine. So I wouldn't play. But you know what, though? We talked about this, and I think people want it so bad, but I don't know. I think
too built up.
Yeah, I think
it's too built up.
I think the shots are exactly what this movie needed. I do. I don't know. There could have been more gore, like, you know, Jason Isaacs' guts hanging out. But these shots of hell, you said once, like, if you start pausing it, like, you know, he actually shot these on the weekends, which is pretty interesting. But if you pause it and you kind of look at it, I don't know if it would hold up. And remember, you and I have talked about how things become funny sometimes in horror, and you got to start, like, thinking about it. There's not enough here for you to, like, think about and go, hey, wait a second. Why is that guy playing tennis in the background? Or, yeah, like, there's just enough to build it up in your head. And I think
sometimes in the moment, our imagination is way more effective than whatever they could do with another 5 or 8 seconds.
Yeah. And I mean, people love this amount. So why, I don't know why you need more. I mean, that's why there are deleted scenes, but, and I don't know. I think the two guys agreed that they didn't have to make, their first cuts were too strong. So that these guys wish that the first cut that they took to audiences was maybe 15 minutes shorter and less like intense. Then they think they could have maybe cut it down by another 5 minutes. But since they started off so strong, there was a very strong reaction against it. And that was very reactive and they had to cut a lot. So it was part of like a learning curve for them. And then it was just, so yeah, there's going to be no director's cut as of now, unless, you know, somehow they find a way to take Transylvania salt mine footage and make it perfect.
That's it's so weird. It's like when I first hear that, I just think that two episodes ago we did Bram Stoker. It's like some Transylvania salt mine. Some gypsies are like harvesting soil in it to transport Dracula to America where he's buying up real estate. Oh, well, that does it for our listener questions. Once again, like, thanks, guys, so much. We really appreciate your listener questions. They help drive our conversation quite a bit and open our eyes to maybe some weird stuff we wouldn't have thought up on our own.
Yeah, no, like, we get some very, I wouldn't think to ask some of these questions, so I really appreciate y'all doing that.
I love the Hellraiser in space comment.
Yeah, that was great. any final thoughts before we go to plugs?
I gotta tell you, so I've watched this movie 3 times in 2 weeks in preparation for this pod, not out of homework obligation, because normally I watch something once. It was just out of pleasure. I just wanted to keep, I wanted to see it again. And I wanted to see it if, oh God, I should just watch it again. And every time I loved it. It was almost like when I do my annual watches. There's something about this movie. They really captured lightning in a bottle and captured some serious entertainment value for me. So awesome.
Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, yeah, I was just because the Resident Evil movies, you know, they're fun and all, but they can get old fast. So yeah, like this was his masterpiece.
Yeah, and I watched this. I did a lot of research just because people have a lot of questions about this movie, so I went out of my way to make sure I could answer anything that they know, and it never felt like homework to me. It felt like I love filmmaking, and you know me, I love everything about filmmaking, and I think I learned a lot about how this movie was made, and I feel like I understand it now from a production standpoint, and I enjoy doing that. Sometimes researching movies are a slog, or commentaries aren't good, and I actually respect Anderson more, and Jeremy for their commentary because I feel like they respected the people who were listening to it. And no, I had a fun time prepping for this.
That is such a great final thought also, because you mentioned it in the first place, and that's why I listened to it. A lot of times directors' commentaries are just there for what I would call fact geeking. You are watching just to know more about the movie. It's not necessarily so enjoyable of a process. This was a very, very, very entertaining commentary. It's very enjoyable. I haven't had so many experiences with commentaries that were so positive.
Yeah, and like there's some bad ones that just are insulting and like, oh, why are you even listening to this? Like this one wasn't that, so I dig it. Plugs?
Well, again, there were the guys who gave us our listener questions and some of our comments. We had player one at Retrobotic with a K. We had at Danny S. Warren, who gave us that quote that F this ship.
Yeah.
At Alex Borkov, who's been he's been participating so much with us the last couple months. The Fear Merchant, who has their own podcast, The Bazaar. And also Scarescapes, which is at D. Carner with a K. Thank you guys for your listener questions. And then I want to thank, again, I think I did a couple weeks ago, but there's some people who just religiously seem to share our material, and we don't ask for it, and they might not all even have their own websites or material for us to share back. But people like on Twitter, Leo Craven, there's an author, John F. Leonard. There's Mr. Horror. There's The Schlockernaut. They have a podcast. And there's Echoes of Horror, which is Grim Horror with two M's. All these people, they just religiously share our material. I'm assuming they like it.
Yeah.
And whenever I see it, you know, I'm just so pleasantly surprised. So, you know, I got to say thanks so much to them. And if you're listening, Johnny Num from the Crash Palace, the Last Knock podcast, and from Loud Green Bird, you gave us a listener question weeks ago about Dwayne Johnson, which I've continued to delay, waiting for the right time, because we keep getting so many wonderful listener questions for the Happy Death Day podcast, the Bram Stoker podcast, coming into this one, the Event Horizon podcast, that it just feels out of place. We're going to use it, and I'm going to let you know when I use it. It's going to be spectacular, but thanks again to Johnny Num, no H in that Johnny. Those are my plugs. Mark, maybe you have some plugs, and maybe you want to give a few highlights about things that we're planning on doing in the near future.
Yeah, next week we're going to be covering Cinematic Sea Beast. So if you have
any... Wait, what do you mean by Sea Beast?
So like the big monsters from Phantom Menace, the genetically modified sharks from Deep Blue Sea, the angry shark from Jaws 4, the merman. Like we're covering... the big sea beast from Valerian, from Deep Rising. We got a lot of sea beasts, folks, and we're going to do like a fun tournament style, kind of break them down. It's going to be a podcast all things sea beasts. So actually, if you have any questions about sea beasts, please send them our way. I would love to get questions about them. Also, a big shout out to Robert Lamb from Seven Lamb Productions. He is crushing it right now. We're part of kind of under his banner. Really good guy. If you get a chance, go to Blog Talk Radio, type in Seven Lamb. Check out all of his stuff. Like, great, great, great stuff. And thank you to everyone who listens. Please make sure to rate, review, and subscribe. And we appreciate you. So, you good, John?
I'm good, guys. That's right. A good night and a cheers from me.
This was fun. So, for me, Mark Hoffmeyer, and John, I Eat Cement Levengood. This is Movies, Films, and Flicks. Have a great night.